date is February, no, March, right, 2018. Talking to Mrs. Dove, and we're finishing a story about Bailey Bell. In the mid-50s, when Talbot had accused Bailey Bell of going through this to the 25.
I don't really remember the story that well, and maybe if I thought about it, I'd remember it better. But my present recollection is that there was some kind of a criminal case, and the assistant U.S. attorneys, of course, prosecuted all territorial criminal cases. And Bailey Bell, allegedly, during a recess, was going through a file that belonged to the U.S. attorney at the counsel table. He was caught in that endeavor by somebody. I don't remember who it was, but my best recollection is that it was a deputy U.S. marshal who, like the U.S. attorneys, had an obligation to enforce territorial laws. And so the U.S. Marshals had dual duty, as the U.S. attorneys did. But he allegedly caught Bailey rifling through this file, and so Talbot had Bell arrested in his office, handcuffed, and taken over to the jail where he was fingerprinted. And I frankly don't remember what happened to the case. Except that Bailey was terribly upset. And that's all I really remember about it.
Did he ever go after Talbot for putting him in handcuffs?
Well, he went after him, you know, in the context of going after him in the Bar Association for having been so badly mistreated, but I don't think he ever filed any cases or anything.
Were there any special privileges as a U.S. attorney? Things that you wouldn't have now. Were there any differences in the U.S. Attorney's office?
Oh, yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, we had little identification cards which allowed us to go into any establishment at any time to determine whether there was a violation of the territorial liquor laws. And so we consequently could use those ID cards to go any place, any time, and find out whether there were any violations of the laws. They don't have that privilege today. I have a great story about being an assistant United States attorney. There was a I suppose it's fair to say that crime was in some respects more prevalent 30 years ago or 25 years ago than it is today. And there was a section of town, what is known as East Chester Flats, where the black substantial amount of the black community resided. Every time you had a case and you asked the address of the defendant, they always said 18th and Carluck. And when I first got here, I conceived that there was a building there that must have been 50 stories high that everybody lived in. But there were a number of all-night places. One of them was called the House of Joy. But there was a guy who was an operator down there. I had a bar whose name was Frank Evans. And he weighed about 300 pounds, big black guy. And every time I saw him on the street, he always bowed down. He was fairly short. Bowed way down. He said, "Hello, Mr. Grow. Hello, Mr. Grow." I said, "Hello, Mr. Evans." And I left the DA's office, and I met him on the street one day, and he says, "Hello, Cliff." And I says, "Hello, Frank." And I says, "How come you don't call me Mr. Grill anymore?" And he says, "You ain't got no power anymore." End of story.
Did you really have power as an assistant U.S. attorney?
Sure you did. Any assistant U.S. attorney or district attorney has power because they have the power to file criminal complaints. And you can shut people down or leave them in operation or file charges or not file charges.
Were there any campaigns to shut down any sections of town or any campaigns to go after establishments?
Sure, there were always campaigns. Judge Fitzgerald, now Judge Fitzgerald, used to be Assistant U.S. Attorney Fitzgerald, and I closed down the line in Seward. And in the early 50s, the line was still operating. And the communities in Alaska then, as the communities in Alaska now, are usually split almost 50-50 on whether there should be prostitution, number one, and number two as to whether you should allow liquor. In 1982, the fight is in the native areas as to whether they should allow liquor or go dry. But in those days, the fight was whether they should allow prostitution or not. And on the one hand, you'd have the church groups, and on the other hand, you'd have the citizens that wanted it. And the community was split about 50-50. But they appeared before a local grand jury, or the people that wanted to close it down, and the grand jury either threatened to indict us or we would close the line down. So we closed the line down.
Is there any record of that?
Sure.
Is there any title that I can use?
I think it's United States of America versus, all I can remember is they were on Alley A or Alley B in Seward, and it was a number of houses that under the law in those days we could abate. And I don't remember the statute specifically, but you could abate the houses and get an injunction against them operating. We went down there in a big raid and swooped down on them and caught part of the city council.
Did you, as assistant U.S. attorneys, actually participate in the raid?
We certainly did.
Did you participate in a lot of raids, or was that a common thing?
Well, there was so few staff people, either in the U.S. attorney's office or in the marshal's office, that we participated in quite a few of them. We raided a house of prostitution. It was located approximately where Rogers Park School is presently located. Called the Texas Playhouse.
After you were in the U.S. Attorney's Office, what did you do? For how long were you there? What years?
I was there in 1954 and part of 55, and then I went into private practice.
In 1955, the Integrated Bar Act passed.
Yes.
Did that have any kind of effect on your practice or on the tenor of the bar at all?
Well, yeah, we had an integrated bar, so, you know, I guess we now had a statewide bar association. We had to set up disciplinary procedures. And I served on some early disciplinary committees. With Judge Ray Plummer, so we also went to statewide conventions. I don't remember when the first one was. I was an early member of the Board of Governors. And 1 year was president of the state bar. I think I was president in 59 and 60.
Why was an integrated bar formed? Was there a lot of discussion about it?
Well, yeah, the primary idea was to take the disciplinary procedures away from the district attorneys. It was unfair to in view of the Stringer case and in view of other cases, to have people who had the power to administer the criminal laws and who were trying criminal cases on behalf of the territory or the United States, to also have the disciplinary power over lawyers that were trying cases against them.
Were there certain people instrumental in founding the integrated bar?
Well, the bar was so small, I don't think it made a heck of a lot of difference. Pete Calamiriti certainly was an important factor. As my recollection is, he was the first executive director and also had been in the legislature that created it. You know, there were certain older lawyers that were advocates of it, Stanley McCutcheon, Wendell Kay, and there were the younger lawyers who were in favor of it. As a matter of fact, I think we're all in favor of it. I don't know who opposed it. I can't think of anybody opposing the integrated bar.
When they set up the disciplinary procedures, did they take a lot of the procedure that the district attorney's office had used? Did they take any?
Didn't take any of it. No. What they did was, or I had a part in that, what we did was we went to other states, found out what the heck kind of rules they had and adopted them here.
Mm-hmm. Was there an effort to be liberal with conservative or?
Well, I venture to guess that most lawyers are usually very liberal with each other. And they wanted to set up some machinery that, I don't know that you can categorize it as liberal or unliberal. We wanted to set up procedures that were in the hands of impartial people so that we could administer the canons of ethics for the bar.
Who were the first people in charge of any kind of disciplinary matters? Was it your committee?
I think so. My best recollection is, and I may be wrong about it, my best recollection is that Ray Plummer, Buell Nesbitt, and I sat on the first disciplinary committee, and when we got complaints, we would go through them, and there was a procedure set up that after it went through the disciplinary committee, it went to the Board of Governors, and then they would recommend court system as to what to be done.
Were there as many proceedings, such as the Stringer and Bell case and that sort of thing, after the bar was set up as before?
Oh, I don't think so.
So it greatly reduced?
Yeah, greatly. Well, but there weren't many even before. Mm-hmm. But, I don't know in total numbers. But I don't think there was a great rash of disciplinary proceedings after the integrated bar was set up. But there hadn't been a great rash of disciplinary proceedings prior to one assistant United States attorney filing a lot of them either.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you were done with the U.S. Attorney's Office, what did you do? Where did you go?
Well, I went into private practice. There had been a U.S. commissioner and ex officio probate judge that I had done a lot of practice before as an assistant United States attorney named Gordon W. Hartley. Mm-hmm. H-A-R-T-L-I-E-B. And there was a city attorney named John L. Rader. And so the three of us decided to form a firm in 1955. Rader was still in the city attorney. Hartley quit the U.S. Commissioner and ex officio probate judge's job, and I quit as Assistant United States Attorney. and we formed a firm. We flipped a coin as to whose name was going to be first. I lost the, actually I won the flip, but he was so adamant that I let him go first. And so we formed a firm called Hartlieb Grow, and then a few months later, Rader came in, and it was Hartlieb Grow and Rader.
Mm-hmm. Was it a three-man firm?
Three-man firm.
Didn't have anybody working for you?
No.
What kind of cases did you handle?
Anything we could get.
Was it hard to get cases?
Well, Rader always said that we were grubbing with the chickens in the yard, and we were trying to get cases, and we did get cases. But I had had, first I'm going to have a look at
how is business with Hartlieb Grow and
Rader?
How did you get business?
Well, we got it. We were, you know, there weren't that many lawyers in town, and so we could get some business. And I had just left the U.S. Attorney's office, so I got a lot of criminal cases on the basis of my reputation there. Mr. Rader was city attorney, and so I think he joined the firm and May or June of 55, and so he brought some city business with him. And Mr. Hartlieb was had been the commissioner and ex officio judge, and so he had a lot of friends in town, so we got some business from there. In our early career, we basically represented the labor movement, and labor lawyers were hard to find. And so I think within the first few years, we probably represented the whole labor movement in Anchorage. Laborers, teamsters, carpenters, laundry workers,
what?
Painters. Mm-hmm. I think the whole labor movement, and that's what we did. Now, we also did negligence work. I also did some criminal defense work. And when I say we were grubbing in the dirt with the chickens, I'm serious about that. I mean, we just hustled along and did our thing. We, Mr. Rader is telling you the story a heck of a lot better than I can, because we had a little office at 5th and E Street where the motor branch of the National Bank of Alaska is. And we needed a new floor in his office. And so we went down to one of the local lumber stores and bought a 4x8 piece of plywood. And we fitted in there and it fit perfectly. And that was the size of his office. In order to, and Mr. Hartlieb's office had the heater in it. It was an oil heater, and I had to go through his office to get to mine. Mine wasn't a heck of a lot bigger than 4x8. And since Hartlieb's first on the door, he had the biggest office, but he also had the heater. But we didn't have a bathroom, so we had to go to the city hall to go to the bathroom. Right, right.
How long did it take for you to build up
the
practice?
I don't know. You build a practice up. You just do work for your clients, and you get new clients, and you settle other matters, and they go away. And but we were all busy, and we all worked very hard, and we didn't make an enormous amount of money, but we made enough to live on. We had a Russian veto system in the firm. Well, you have to have unanimity before you take any course of action.
Did you get anything done?
Yeah. Well, that didn't have to do with the trying of cases or anything, but that had to do with what investments we were going to make, and whether we were going to switch kinds of clients or get into certain kinds of business. And frankly worked out fairly well. If you can achieve, if you're reasonable persons and you can achieve unanimity, then everybody goes forward. But we were both social friends and law partners, and we did all these things together.
Just a question going back a little bit to when you were a U.S. attorney. How did the criminal defense work? How were lawyers appointed to defend the criminal? There was no public defender at the time.
Well, the court just had a list, and if a criminal defendant was indigent, he would go down the list and the next guy in line would get the case. But I certainly have handled my share of those, but most of the time, if the defendant had money, he'd hire, one of the top criminal defense lawyers in town. And most defendants had some money.
Did you get paid if you were appointed by the court?
I can't remember what it was, but my best recollection is that it was $25 an hour.
Was that good or bad in those days?
Well, it wasn't up to... That was not equivalent to what we were charging.
Yeah. How long did you stay with Hartley Brown Rader?
Well, our firm, I think, lasted the law firm, I think, lasted 7 years. Mr. Rader took a leave of absence and became Alaska's first attorney general. In addition to being lawyers, we're businessmen. We were different in that respect from a lot of the lawyers in town who didn't understand business. We bought and sold lots of properties. And so we supplemented our other income, our law income, by being in real estate.
Mm-hmm. Was that more profitable than the lawyer end of it, than the law end of it?
Listen, if you sell one piece of property, you make $100,000, that's a lot of divorces.
So by the end, had you started out with the intent of being both a business corporation or a business entity and a law firm?
We certainly did.
Who had the idea?
All of us. It was a joint idea.
Why?
Just because we figured out that it was a heck of a lot easier to sell a piece of property than to do 25 divorces. we were knowledgeable in real estate. Mr. Rader had left to become attorney general. Mr. Hartlieb and I continued to practice law. Mr. Rader was also in the legislature. We went into a variety of businesses, not businesses, but real estate. We shied away from operating businesses. It's too hard to be there when the guy's counting the money. So we'd buy real estate and sell real estate. Mm-hmm. We bought. And we were acquainted with the market conditions in Anchorage. We bought a piece of property one time for $45,000. The market went up. We sold it for $75,000. The market went down. We bought it again for $45,000. The market went up, and we sold it again for $75,000. So we made $30,000 on that piece of property twice. Mm-hmm. So I guess we were good at it.
It sounds like it. After. You split up. Well, what made you split up?
Or, what makes marriages split up? Something happens. I think we split up in 62. Mr. Rader wanted to run for governor. I didn't mind him running for governor. He's a good friend of mine. He and I are still partners in various enterprises. But I didn't think I should practice law while he ran for governor.
Why not?
Because political power is not assignable. And the fact that he was governor wasn't really going to help me. And I didn't want to work all the hours that I was working while he ran for governor. But there was nothing, we weren't unhappy with each other in that respect. I just explained to him that I wanted to dissolve the firm if he was going to run for governor, so I dissolved the firm.
How did Mr. Hartley feel about it all?
I think he agreed with me.
Were either of the two of you political? Did you
agree? Oh, we all were political in a sense. Mr. Hartley and I happened to be Republicans. Mr. Rader happened to be a Democrat. That was not uncommon in Anchorage in those days. Matter of fact, it was common. One partner would be a Democrat, and some of the others would be Republicans. But that didn't have anything to do with it. Our friendship overcame all that. I subsequently, years later, in 72, 1, 2, 3, and 4, served in the legislature with Mr. Rader in the Senate, and we'd fight periodically on the floor, but we have always remained good friends. During that period of time, I guess we had a lot of big cases. I can't even remember them all. But one of them was the United States versus the Anchorage Central Labor Council. And we were still representing a lot of the labor movement. But in that case, we got declared unconstitutional, although the judge never really got to that question, the issue of contributions by labor unions to political parties. I had a whole lot of criminal cases, murder cases, all kinds. I spent an awful lot of time in the courtroom. And I guess mundane things like regular cases, divorce cases, foreclosures, etc. We concentrated on the commercial. Our non-labor practice was basically commercial banks. That's what we did.
Is that First National Bank of Anchorage? Or that?
I have never represented the First National Bank, National Bank of Alaska.
National Bank of Alaska.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with. Is there a rivalry between the two banks? Is there? I've heard that the lawyers are split between both banks. So bank at one bank and not the other bank.
I think that's true, but that's inevitably true, I think. They're competitors, you know, so there's a certain amount of rivalry.
It doesn't go back to is there some underlying story to it?
They're just competitors.
Is that it?
Yeah.
After you split up, what did you do?
I formed a firm called Groen Benkert. He had been a law clerk of the Groen Rader. And so that he and I formed a firm, and we practiced for a number of years.
Did you have any other law clerks while you were at Lee Brown Rader?
Oh, Mr. Walton.
Mr. Who?
Pete Walton.
Oh, Pete Walton.
And yeah, we had a number of them. I can't even remember what all their names are. This is Mr. Roth, who was here and then left the state. Mr. Walton. I can't remember the names of any others.
when you were, I just forgot his name.
Hartley Berater?
No, when you're the second that, well, who did you just say you formed a partnership with?
Benkert, Ron Benkert, yeah. B-E-N-K-E-R-T.
Yeah. Did you keep doing corporate transactions and... it sounds more like real estate transactions.
Corporate real estate, some union.
Mm-hmm. The next question I had was that you're Republican. Was there any kind of strain to do all this labor work? Republicans aren't usually representing labor. You don't hear about that very often.
Oh, I don't know that made a great deal of difference.
It didn't make some policy.
Yeah. I had, during this period of time, in 55 I ran for the school board, and I was on the school board, and I was president of the school board. I was on there for 4 years. I subsequently, as I indicated to you, went on the board of governors of the Bar Association and was president for a year. I subsequently went on the city council and was acting mayor. And I
said, acting mayor?
Yeah.
When? What
were the circumstances? Well, Mr. Rasmussen, who's the chairman of the board of the National Bank of Alaska, was the mayor, and he was gone all the time, and so I was vice mayor, so I acted as mayor most of that year. And I spent time on the city council and on the borough assembly. I was on the first borough assembly. And then subsequent to that, I was chairman of the Charter Commission, which unified the city and the borough. Mm-hmm. Subsequent to that, I was in the state senate. What was your question?
This is while you were practicing with Mr. Benkert?
No, this was when I was with Hartley Brown Rader and with Mr. Benkert and with my subsequent firms. But that's a lot of years of public service.
So how do you manage to find time to do both that and your practice and
you run quickly. I'd always been in public service and I stayed in it and I still practiced.
Do you think there's many lawyers now are doing that much public service as there were
there isn't, because all you have to do is look at the makeup of the legislature. In local public offices, on the present municipal assembly, which is the combination of the borough and the city, you have two lawyers that I can think of offhand. I don't think there are any more than two. You've got Josephson and Walsh. Mm-hmm. But at one time, in the legislature was basically made up of mostly lawyers, and that isn't true anymore.
Why?
Well, because you can't run for the legislature and be in public office and retain any semblance of a law practice, number one. And number two, there is very little glory in being in public office anymore. There was never much glory in it, but at least you were half-heartedly respected before if you were willing to devote your time to the office, and I don't think that's true anymore. I can tell you why I think that's true, because the local press, maybe Watergate, whatever, has made performing public service a terrible chore, because you're automatically assumed to be crooked, rotten, dirty, filthy, and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And why take the grief of running for public office? Thanks to one of the Anchorage newspapers, there are no heroes in Alaska. Everything is torn down instead of saying, I think Mr. Rader is a perfect example. He was in the legislature, ran public office for 16 years. And because he happens to disagree, and he did a very valuable service, but because he happens to disagree with one of the local newspapers on the capital move issue, he was constantly denigrated, cut up, ridiculed, in the fact that, for example, that he passed the first borough law, the fact that he was single-handedly passed the abortion law, or at least fought the fight, or was at the head of the fight, the fact that he was a competent legislator for years, is never recognized. If any one person was responsible for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline law getting through the legislature, I was. But nobody knows that, and nobody cares less. Incidentally, if we didn't have the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, neither you nor I would be here.
Couldn't you retain your semblance of law practice now and be in the
legislature? Well, because it takes too much time, and you can't be in two places at once. You can't be in Juneau for, and I served one session for, and I don't know, I was 71 or 72, for 160 days. You can't be in Juneau for 160 days and run back here for 200 days and endeavor to maintain a law practice unless you have extremely generous law partners who are willing to live with that result. But there aren't many of those around.
After, when you were with Bankrupt, what other things did you do besides public service and criminal and corporate work? Did you do any Native work?
Well, I certainly did.
Did it?
In 1966, Mr. McCutcheon and I, and I don't care what the Native history books say, I'm going to tell you what happened, and I have the records to prove it. Sat at the quarter deck of the Captain Cook and decided to create the Alaska Federation of Natives. And we at that time were representing a Native village over here who had come into some wealth, known as the Native Village of Tyonek, who had collected $14 million as a result of a lawsuit that Mr. McCutcheon had filed against the Department of Interior, and he got the $14 million for the Natives. And after having built that village created homes for everybody and done everything else, why, we decided that we would try to organize an Alaska Federation of Natives. And so we called some leadership together, and all kinds of guys presently take credit for this, but I have the correspondence to prove that we did it, if anybody wants to see it.
I'd love to see it.
And we wrote to various guys who now presently run around and say it was their idea, but that's not important. And we used the Tyonek money to have the first statewide Alaska Federation of Natives meeting, which was held in October 1966. I even have correspondence and memos between Mr. McCutcheon and me as to who we should make the first president of the Alaska Federation of Natives. Now, the people involved don't want to admit that, but that is the fact. And obviously, nobody had any money to do it except the Tyoneks, and it was through the Tyoneks, which that's the way it was done. And so I wrote the first constitution for the Alaska Federation of Natives, which I incidentally copied from the Teamsters Constitution. Nobody wants to admit that either, but that's where it came from. And, the little triple symbol of the natives, the three rings that look like the Olympic rings. Mr. Don Wright and I picked those off a Schaefer's beer bottle in New Jersey one time.
Where?
In New Jersey, that's where they sell Schaefer's. We put Eskimo Indian and Aleut on the rings. Well, we put Eskimo Indian and Aleut on, and that's where the symbols came from. And after we created, or helped create the Federation of Natives, it's always an argument as to how much the lawyer does and how much the people do, you know. But that was our first meeting, and so then I became general counsel for the Federation of Natives. And Mr. McCutcheon and I represented almost all of the native groups in the state, except for three, I guess. We never represented Nana, which is the Kotzebue group. We never represented the North Slope, four. We never represented Fairbanks or Doyon, and we never represented Southeastern.
Why not?
Because they had other lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
Or they got other lawyers, or they had other lawyers.
Who were the other lawyers involved?
Well, Barry Jackson from Fairbanks, mm-hmm. Roger Connor, who's now in the Supreme Court, represented the Aleuts. And Fred Paul from Seattle represented the North Slope. But our law firm represented Kodiak, Bristol Bay, Unalakleet, Nome, Eklutna, Kenai, Copper River, Cordova or Chugach. You know, I don't know whether there were any others, but that's certainly out of the 12 regionals, we represented probably eight of them.
Now, is this your firm with McCutcheon? Was Banker with you at this time?
The name of the firm in 1966. Maybe 65, we formed a firm called McCutcheon Grown Benker. What had happened is McCutcheon represented the Tyonics. He needed some help. He approached me. We joined forces and we made the firm. And our goal was going to be to represent the Native movement. That's what we did.
Was this after the Tyonic settlement, or this was after? Did you ever join forces with the other attorneys?
Oh, we all did.
When did you?
Well, during the October 66 convention, you know, when natives came in from all over the state, that was the first statewide convention that was ever held. Their other lawyers came in, and we participated in a variety of conferences and discussions with the other lawyers as to how we should settle native claims.
Mm-hmm.
So from the beginning we worked together.
Mm-hmm. And what did you decide to do?
Well, there are all kinds of books written about this, and that's a whole different subject. The most definitive book on the subject is my own son's book, which he wrote as a senior thesis at Harvard. And it's never been published, but I'm sure you can get a copy. But in any event, you know, we could talk for 4 days on the issue of native claims.
Why don't you tell me about Mr. McCutcheon then? Because I know
very
little about him.
Well,
Mr.
McCutcheon was a brilliant young man. He was born in Anchorage, went through Anchorage grade school and high school, never went to a day of college nor to a day of law school. He read law under Mr. Grigsby, and he passed the bar. He was always a very prominent Democratic politician at one stage. his father and his brother, who's Steve McCutcheon, who's a non-lawyer, and he all served in the legislature together. His great political allies were Senators Bartlett and Greening, and maybe I should say Greening and Bartlett. And he's a good criminal lawyer because of his lack of formal education in the law. He was not a brilliant brief writer. He was a trial lawyer. And the reason that he and I joined up is because I had had the formal background and could do the legal memorandum, and I was a fair trial lawyer myself, and so we joined together and went forward from there.
Did he ever tell you why he went out of the criminal work to work with natives, to do native work?
Well, I don't know that he ever told me. He was a great believer in helping the underdog, the minority. He always had a great deal of sentiment for the oppressed. And that was a natural thing for him, and I suppose it was natural that he should drift into representing the native groups. Mm-hmm. And he was a dramatist. I'll tell you one story about him. Prior to statehood, the big thing in Alaska was to oppose fish traps. Salmon fish traps, and he had a speech against salmon fish traps that I heard him give at least 30 times, but he made me cry every time he gave it. It was that good speech. And he had been